You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 75 by Rudolf Steiner. I think it's 8 lectures and discussions. I'm calling them all lectures for the sake of easiness, I guess. Called Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, translated by Sabine Seiler. Forgive me for her pronunciation of her name. This is Lecture 6, entitled Anthroposophy and Science, given in Basel on November 2, 1921. Ladies and gentlemen, Anthroposophy, as we intend to cultivate it in the Goetheanum in Dornach, still has many different opponents these days, many opponents whose views are based on religious and clerical thinking. And we find some opponents even among artists. The opposition to Anthroposophy is not always based on factual grounds, but emerges from various party views and from different areas of society. Today I will not concern myself with all those opponents in more detail, but will instead focus only on a way to deal with the misunderstandings and antagonism that anthroposophical research encounters in the natural sciences. I am convinced that, though it seems necessary to defend ourselves against those other opponents, they will gradually disappear on their own when the controversy between anthroposophy and science has been brought into the forms necessary for the two sides to really understand each other. At the moment, the situation is such that particularly the natural sciences meet anthroposophy with the greatest misunderstandings. As an introduction, I want to emphasize that what I advocate as the method of anthroposophical research, for this is what I want to call it, definitely wants to stand on a scientific basis, and it wants to arrange its examinations in such a way that this scientific basis becomes possible and excludes any kind of dilettantism or the like. From the outset, the development of the anthroposophical method of research has taken into account scientific requirements and the entire scientific attitude of our times. Indeed, anthroposophy does not of its own accord place itself in some kind of opposition to modern science. On the contrary, anthroposophy wants to take up what has developed in the course of modern civilization in the past 3 or 4 centuries, especially in the 19th century until today, in terms of scientific precision and exact scientific methods, as they have emerged particularly in the natural sciences. Although anthroposophy must everywhere go beyond the results, and even beyond the realm of the natural sciences as they are understood today, anthroposophy wants to apply the underlying scientific discipline and scientific methods to inner schooling in the anthroposophical method. I will not be able today to present a talk on the fundamentals, but can only touch on certain points and then indicate the connecting lines to the recognized areas of present-day science. What anthroposophy initially claims are special methods of acquiring knowledge. That is, methods that differ from the ones usually considered methods of acquiring knowledge, even though the former grow quite organically out of the latter. Today, people assume that to do scientific research, one must begin on the basis of the kind of knowledge that develops in ordinary life after one has been educated in schools, and then begins to explore the various areas of outer nature, including the human being, by means of experiments and observation and materialistic thinking. Anthroposophy cannot stand on such a basis. Instead, its basis is the certainty that just as we can develop our soul faculties from early childhood to an adult's normal soul condition, or to what is considered to be a normal condition of the soul today, so too is it possible to develop further capacities for knowledge by starting from the normal soul condition and then, if I may say so, taking the life of our soul into our own hands. These capacities for knowledge then enable us to gain deeper insights into the life of nature and the human being, into the phenomena around us, than we could without such specially developed capacities. Such capacities are not developed in some arbitrary way of managing the life of our soul. Rather, they are developed systematically, not in dealing with developing skills for external operations, not with the application of the rules of thinking recognized by ordinary logic, but rather through the development of our deepest soul life. Today, I can only give you a general indication of the methods applied in the development of these suprasensory faculties of the soul. In my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, and in the second part of title An Outline of Esoteric Science, I have provided detailed descriptions of how we can proceed to develop such capacities out of the depths of our soul life. Capacities, if I may put it in such trivial terms, that enable us to see more than we can explore with our ordinary intellectual thinking, with experimentation and observation. I have called the first stage of such knowledge imaginative cognition, and by this term I do not mean that we should develop the ability to cultivate illusions and fantasies in our soul. Rather, what I mean is a cognition that, in contrast to ordinary abstract cognition, is pictorial or imaginative, which is what we need to explore the actual mysteries of being. This pictorial cognition, as I said, I can only point out the fundamentals here, is attained after lengthy work on our soul, in which we apply meditation to such an extent as to develop and enhance our inner soul capacities. Of course, this depends on a person's individual abilities, and some need more time to achieve this, others less. In any case, this meditative inner life consists, for example, in forming easily comprehensible, clearly structured mental pictures and allowing them to be fully present in our ordinary consciousness, focusing, in a sense, all the strength of our soul on these clear mental pictures. As I said, you can find the details in the above-mentioned books. And of course, we can also use mental pictures that someone knowledgeable about these things provides. What matters is that these mental pictures are clear, readily comprehensible, and that we can easily understand as we focus on them. What is achieved in this way? I want to explain to you what is thus achieved by way of a comparison. If you continuously use the muscles in your arm, especially if you do so in a specific and systematic way, your muscles will become stronger. Now, if you use the capacities of your soul similarly, by concentrating them on a goal you have chosen yourself, on a soul content of your choice, then those capacities will grow. You will gain strength. And as a result, you will become able, purely inwardly, without taking into consideration any outer sensory impressions, to develop a strength of soul that is usually applied only to impressions of our senses coming from the outside world. The sensory impressions from the outside world are concrete and pictorial. If you have ever reflected on your soul, you know that you develop a more intense soul life when you immerse yourself in sense impressions from the outside world than when you focus on abstract ideas or memories that are left behind, when you turn your perception away from the outer senses and restrict it to your soul life as such. Your soul life, as it resonates and reverberates in the aftermath of lively, rich, sensory impressions. What matters above all, ladies and gentlemen, is to strengthen our inner soul life to such an extent that in this greater strength we can have something that we can otherwise have in this life between birth and death only when we abandon ourselves to the power and intensity of sensory impressions coming from the outside. In this way, we attain a pictorial imagination that is indeed different from our usual abstract imagination, to put it in more scientific terms, it differs from that ordinary kind of imagination through which we visualize natural laws on the basis of observation and experiments. That is, we become inwardly so strengthened that we have not only the kind of thinking and the kind of inner soul life we normally have, for example, when we comprehend the laws of nature, but rather the kind that is present when we grasp the pictorial quality in external perception. In other words, our thinking becomes more inwardly pictorial. We no longer think only in abstract thoughts, but learn to live in inner pictures. As soon as we characterize such a developed inner contemplative capacity of perception, people say right away that anthroposophy wants to develop something that is actually already known as subordinate soul capacities, as capacities that partially or entirely, depending on how you look at it, fall into the category of the pathological. Moreover, people say that when one strengthens one's inner contemplative capacities of perception to the point of attaining the capacity to arrive at inner pictures without having taken those pictures from the external world of the senses, then one gives oneself over to a capacity that is pretty much hallucinatory, namely a capacity to imagine all kinds of phantasms and the like. Indeed, scientists in our day have repeatedly argued that what anthroposophy claims to be inner contemplation in pictures must be traced back to suppressed forces of the nerves that then, at opportune moments, arise from within due to the person's intensified inner life. In other words, they contend that these inner pictures are nothing other than the manifestation of a suppressed life of the nerves. But scientists who confuse in this way anthroposophical contemplation with hallucinations, as they are called in daily life, clearly have not looked thoroughly at what anthroposophical contemplation really is. First of all, we could respond to such arguments by drawing people's attention to the fact that, above all, anthroposophy takes care everywhere to proceed with the same strictness as the natural sciences themselves in all matters that these external natural sciences are concerned with. And anthroposophy considers the most important preparation to be the recognized methods of the natural sciences. It only moves on from there beyond the natural sciences. Therefore, one should really not say that people grounded solidly in anthroposophy show any signs of indulging in visions like any psychic medium or visionary does. You will never see psychics or visionaries of any kind base themselves firmly on the natural sciences and take them as their starting point, so that what they claim are their visions would then arise directly out of these strict scientific methods. But that is not even what I wanted to talk about. Rather, I want to point out that anthroposophy requires a more thorough and more precise method of thinking than is usually evident or applied in such objections directed against it. What we see here, above all, is that those arguments are still not based on a truly thorough understanding of the soul or psychology. Modern psychology, indeed, still leaves much to be desired. It is clearly not at all on a par with the exact methods of the natural sciences. In fact, in many ways, modern psychology is a welter of old traditional concepts distilled down to mere words and all sorts of abstractions. It is not based on a real observation of the life of the soul, on an exact empirical understanding of soul life. Such an exact empirical psychology would, above all, have to ask what is going on with our external sensory perception, what is active in our sensory perception. In our soul life as a whole, thinking, feeling, and willing are involved. But our soul life is not structured in such a way that we can separate thinking, feeling, and willing from each other, except abstractly. Instead, everything our soul can do in any way involves thinking, feeling, and willing. All we can really say is that feeling and willing are also at play in the life of thought when we are thinking. When we pass an affirming or dissenting judgment in the life of thought, then our soul life is oriented toward the outside, but the affirmation or dissent is carried out through an impulse of the will. That impulse of the will definitely plays a role in the life of thought. And the only way to get an exact idea of the soul life and its various expressions is to be entirely clear everywhere about how great a part feeling plays in willing, or conversely, what part thinking plays in willing, and so on. Of course, it is relatively easy to understand that willing plays a part in the life of our thinking. I've just spoken about passing judgments. And if we really study what happens in judging, we will readily see how willing plays its part in thinking. And this is important, ladies and gentlemen. Our will also plays a part in our sensory perception. And here I must draw your attention to something that the psychology of our time seems not to know at all, or at least not to characterize sufficiently. And that is the fact that in our sensory perception, in our seeing, hearing, and all other sensory perceptions, the will definitely plays a role. What is actually happening in our sensory perception? When we perceive anything, we are inwardly active in each act of our soul, even when we are facing the outer world seemingly passively. In what we bring through our inner activity to our encounters with the outer world, that is, when we thus expose ourselves to any sensory perception, our will is alive, albeit in a diluted, filtered way. Our will lives in this. Though I could spend hours telling you in detail what is happening here, today I can only give you an indication. The essential thing about sensory perception is that this will that we expose, in a way, from the inside to the outside, is beaten back by various agents. We can understand the nature of the stimulus and of our sensory perception overall only when we can look closely at this play of the will, moving from the inside to the outside, and then the counterblow from the natural agents that comes from the outside to the inside. That is, we must become aware that every act of sensory perception involves a beating back of the will, and everything that remains of the sensory perception as a memory or other mental picture is actually a will impulse that has been pulled back, withdrawn. And thus, by exposing our senses in this way, we can distinguish between what plays a role originating in the will and what, starting from the entire act of perception, then continues in the life of thought. Thus, as I indicated, the will lives also in the life of thought, and it lives there in such a way that our inner being plays a much greater role in the unfolding of the will into the life of thinking than in its unfolding into the life of the senses. Initially, our will remains, above all, far more active, subjective, and personal in thinking than in sensory perception. You see, ladies and gentlemen, everything I described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds regarding the development of supra-sensory cognitive capacities was aimed at making you fully aware of this will that plays a role in sensory perceptions. Indeed, this will must also be applied even by the most precise natural sciences. And then we must organize the life of thought within us in such a way that what is living there is not the subjective, arbitrary will, if I may put it that way, but rather the same objective will that lives in sensory perception. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, the way I mean it, does not aim to draw up all sorts of things from the depths of soul life in a nebulous and mystical way, so as to perhaps press a subjective will into the life of thinking. This subjective will is already present in ordinary life, but through the exercises for the attainment of higher knowledge, this will must be detached from the life of thought. And instead, the will that we train ourselves to understand and that lives in sensory perception, and really only in sensory perception, that will must penetrate the life of thinking in a disciplined way. And if I may say so, with this we achieve something tremendous. Our entire life of thinking takes on the character that usually is only inherent in sensory perception. This is something every individual must discover personally for him or herself. We all know that we can think all kinds of things, and our will can play a role in this by turning our judgment this way or that. What does not live in this thinking? But when we use our senses, the outer world forces us to discipline our will in the way in which we can apply our will in sensory perception, and then it is impossible to arbitrarily assert our inner subjectivity. I want to remind you that anthropological psychology has already explained from another perspective how the will lives in our sensory perceptions. Here I just want to mention Lotze's local signs and the like. We must bring this will, which is leaping over into objectivity, into our thinking. For only then can we shape the life of thought in such a way that it becomes imaginative cognition and has as much of a share in objectivity as our sensory perception usually does. You see, compared to what I could only roughly sketch for you now, and what is absolutely meant in the most precise sense, not in the sense that we can now indulge in all sorts of fantastic imaginations about inner soul development, as nebulous mystics do. Compared to all of this, even the arguments coming these days from the established sciences are basically extremely amateurish for those of us who know something about the matter. In contrast to everything that can show up in hallucinations, dreams, and what arises subjectively out of our physical organization, that is, in contrast to every instance in which we live without any objective orientation, totally given over to our inner life, we now develop a life of the imagination that replicates the objectivity of outer sensory life. Thus, in a way, the objectivity of sensory perception is extended inward to include the life of the imagination. In contrast, what we find in mediumship and in pathological clairvoyance is that what leads to pictorial images, to hallucinatory life, is drawn up from within the person. That is not at all the case with the methods we apply in anthroposophical studies and research. There we do not proceed from the inside outward, as basically all mysticism has been doing up to now, but rather we proceed from the outside inward. There it is not inner mystical feeling, but outer sensory perception that teaches us how to adopt an objective stance toward the world. And then we will discover that because we have been taught in this way by sensory perception, we will become capable of shaping our life of imagination into something as concrete, as inwardly rich, as what we otherwise only find in sensory perception. And when we have achieved such an inwardly rich imagining, which now, just like sensory perception, flows into something objective, for it is thus no longer merely subjectively focused, that is, when we have developed such an imaginative thinking, as I like to call it, then and only then will we be able to advance from a certain level in the knowledge of nature to another level, which I will characterize shortly. But before I do that, I first want to say that anthroposophical spiritual science, as I mean it, has sincerely tried to clarify in every direction the position of such an imaginative cognition. And ladies and gentlemen, allow me, as I am, after all, the main representative of this anthroposophical spiritual science, to interpolate something personal, which is not meant to be personal, but is actually objectively connected with how I arrived at not only developing the anthroposophical methods, but, undeterred by any difficulties or hardships, believing in these anthroposophical methods and seeing them as legitimate paths to knowledge. For, ladies and gentlemen, please do not think that one who takes these things seriously is uncritical and simply does not want to grapple with the most thorough and precise critical epistemological methods of today. When I was about 13 years old, I happened upon a treatise that was written along the lines of the predominant thinking of the 1870s. That is, the treatise aimed at exploring the outer phenomena of nature in an exact way through calculations. It accepted as laws of nature only what could be calculated. That treatise sought to throw out every last mystical concept from the knowledge of nature. One of those mystical concepts, according to that treatise, was gravity, the gravitational force as identified by Newton. The treatise was entitled The Force of Gravity as an Effect of Motion. The treatise opposed the mystical concept of gravity, according to which two material bodies attract each other in some way through space. Instead, in an extraordinarily mathematically exact way, the treatise sought to explain gravitational force thus. Ponderable matter is inside a cosmic gas, and therefore a certain number of colliding impacts between neighboring material bodies can be calculated. If the number of impacts coming from the inside is compared with the number of impacts coming from the outside, the result will be a pure explanation of gravity that is free of all mysticism. I mention this because the encounter with that treatise, as I said, came in my 13th year. In order to understand that treatise, which you can well imagine was not an easy thing for a 13-year-old, I had to attempt to master differential and integral calculus at that age, because only then can those ideas really be mastered. And this gave me the opportunity to come upon a starting point for everything that was then necessary in order to deal epistemologically with the notions and ideas that have always lived in me with a sort of general certainty. We must really get a clear view of how we apply mathematical laws or laws of kinematics in all our sensory perception. We must get a clear picture of what is actually going on there, what we ourselves bring to the encounter with the outside world, and so on. In short, for me, that treatise provided the starting point for exploring the question of the extent to which that curious region of the soul we call mathematics can actually master outer reality. Heinrich Schramm, the author of that treatise, which I still consider extremely important, was thoroughly convinced that mathematics could take us everywhere. According to him, if we presuppose matter, space, and motion, then mathematics would get us everywhere. Schramm was sure that all the various characteristics of nature in ordinary mechanics, thermodynamics, optics, magnetism, and electricity, could be grasped ultimately by way of mathematics. In Schramm's view, we can really gain insight into those various phenomena in the right way if we correctly apply mathematics. Thus, when we apply mathematics to a hypothetical material process, magnetism jumps out at us. And when we apply mathematics to another process, electrical applications jump out at us. In short, all natural phenomena are explained as an effect of motion. This explanation is entirely free of mysticism and restricts itself to the world of perception. It can be comprehended by way of purely mathematical ideas. This grappling with a kind of knowledge that approaches the outer world mathematically and wants to comprehend sensory perceptions mathematically is not easy. It must be gone through. After all, the outer world must be grasped in some way, even if one proceeds ever so mathematically. There was another thing that followed for me from all this. I immersed myself in what in mathematics is called probability theory, in which one seeks to calculate the probability, for example, of rolling a certain number with two dice, let's say a 1 and a 2. This area of mathematics, probability calculus, plays a very big role in the insurance industry. There, probability theory finds real application. Based on the number of deaths among a larger population, insurers calculate the probability that some person, for example a 30-year-old man, will still be alive at the age of 60. and based on that result, the person's insurability and his insurance premium are assessed. In this way, we enter in a strange way into reality with our calculations. You will easily see that this is the case from the fact that in theory everyone can calculate his or her lifespan in such a way that it is sufficiently long for the insurance industry. For example, at the age of 30, I could have decided to take out life insurance. It would then have been necessary to calculate how long I would probably live, and thus how much I would have to pay over that time span. Of course, nobody believes that a person really has to die when the probable lifespan has expired. What we have here is a realm where the application of mathematics is valid for what it wants to achieve, but where the individual life as such does not at all fit into the mathematical formulas, where life as such remains outside the mathematical formulas. In some areas of the natural sciences, we have a certain inner cognitive satisfaction when we assume that what we understand mathematically is commensurate with what we encounter in the outer sensory world. But particularly in the areas where probability calculus plays a role, something else is present. And we have to admit that while mathematics is sufficient for outer life, for what happens in the observation of the outside world, we can never be convinced that the inner life can also be mastered with mathematics. I would really have to tell you about many more intermediate lengths to show you how, from those ideas, I arrived at the chapter about the value of human life in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom, the first edition of which was published in 1893. In that chapter, I was concerned above all with fighting pessimism as such. Back then, pessimism dominated the philosophical views in certain circles to a much greater extent than has been the case since then. Basically, that pessimism originated with Schopenhauer, but was systematically established by Edward von Hartmann. Hartmann approached ethics, social ethics, on the basis of calculation and numbers. You will find his calculations still highly interesting if you look them up. He tried to calculate and post in the credit column, as it were, everything that brings people pleasure, joy, happiness, and so on. And in the negative column he put everything that causes people suffering, pain, unhappiness, and so on. And then he subtracted one column from the other, and indeed came up with the plausible result that for most people the unhappy and painful things outweigh the others, that the negatives outweigh the positives. You can think whatever you like about such philosophical trifles, but for those who want to advance to the foundations of knowledge, these are not trifles at all. And indeed, they must not be so if we wish to emerge from the miserable state of our contemporary intellectual life. For me, that became a very important problem because I said to myself, people do not feel the way this calculation would have us believe. Indeed, it is nonsense, as you will see the moment you tell people that if they were to add up their happiness and their unhappiness, the number in the negative column would be greater than that in the positive column, and then ask them whether that would be a reason for them to consider their life a failure. Would this be a reason for considering suicide, as Edward von Hartmann believes it should be, if only people were rational? For Edward von Hartmann, his calculations said yes to suicide. But life never says yes to this. Why not? Now, I showed in my title, Philosophy of Freedom, that von Hartmann's subtraction is not generally carried out. Instead, if we want to apply any mathematical operation at all, we must apply an entirely different one, namely a fraction or division. The numerator or dividend would contain all happiness, everything pleasurable, everything that satisfies us. The denominator or divisor would contain everything that causes us suffering, unhappiness, pain, and so on. When you apply this division operation, you would have to have an infinite denominator in order to get a result of zero as the outcome of a life. If you have only a finite number of suffering and pain with which you can divide, you will never get zero as the sum total of a life. That is, human beings do not kill themselves as a result of a subtraction. And by showing that we must not subtract here, but at most must divide or work with fractions, I could also show at the same time that for mathematics one has to start in a certain case from life. That is, we must first gain access to life, have a direct perception of life, before we can apply the mathematical approach. Here I have gathered the three important points. First, there is the mathematical approach of the natural sciences, which, with its probability calculus, can be commensurate with outer facts, but which is still not sufficient for reality. Then we have reality as we grasp it in its real individual configuration. And finally, we have reality itself, which we see directly as what masters the mathematical approach. There we come to the limits of what is mathematically possible if we start from mathematics itself. And when we have realized in this way that it is necessary to go beyond mathematics and to grapple with this problem, and when, on the other hand, we have attained the kind of imagining I spoke of today, then we find that we have, in reality, made the leap that takes us beyond the abstract thinking we encounter in the purest forms of mathematics and brings us into immediate reality. And only then did it become possible to understand in an epistemological manner what Goethe himself could not yet give, and then deepen and elaborate Goethe's morphology. For what matters now is that upon attaining that imaginative conception, we begin to understand what Goethe meant when he developed his archetypal plant, that is, a form perceived and grasped inwardly, spiritually, that underlies all the various and widely differing plants. Goethe said that once we have grasped this archetypal plant, we will theoretically be able to invent many different plants that have the ability to grow. That is, we will be able to replicate the nature process within us, our inner soul process, ahead of the natural process, can let many different plant forms arise out of the one archetypal plant. It can replicate how nature creates all its various plant forms out of the one archetypal plant. There, Goethe had already achieved the transition from purely abstract thinking to what I want to call, in quotes, thinking in forms. And this is how Goethe arrived at a true morphology. Let me characterize this thinking in forms a bit more. What are we actually doing in geometry? In geometry, we are dealing with geometrical forms, particularly in plane geometry, but also in solid geometry. In geometry, we are essentially trying to master the forms through numbers, for measuring is ultimately also a matter of numbers. In other words, we are trying to squeeze the forms into abstract numbers. But as I have just explained, mathematics has its limits. If we really want to get out into reality, we have to leave mathematics behind. And then we can find the path from merely reducing geometrical forms to numbers to the direct grasping of geometrical forms themselves. Once we have followed through earnestly with this inner grasping of geometry, then we can also find the way to other forms, to those forms Goethe meant when he spoke about the archetypal plant that can then inwardly, in the most varied ways, take the form of a great many different plants. Just as in a triangle, one angle can be smaller and another larger, and thus we have the different kinds of triangles, so out of the archetypal plant, once its law has been grasped, all sorts of plants can develop that we can then grasp in our soul. In a sense, Goethe arrived at his morphology in a subjective way and developed it only to a certain point. But when we drive the will, which usually lives only in our sensory perception, into the life of the imagination, we systematically develop imaginative concepts, and that is thinking in forms. Now we have an overview of the level in the knowledge of nature where we have natural laws that can be grasped in abstract thoughts. We can apply this thinking to the inorganic, inanimate world. But as soon as we want to advance to the organic world of plants, we need what I have called thinking in forms. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, people may rant and rave against this kind of thinking in forms, and insist that true science can advance only in a discursive way, and must move from one thought to the next, that is, in what is nowadays called the logical method. And they may vociferously claim that this alone is what makes a science true science. Yes, people can decree that this is true science, all they want. But if nature, if the plant kingdom, for example, does not open itself to this science, does not allow itself to be pressed into this science, then we clearly need another science. When purely discursive thinking, purely abstract thinking, is not sufficient, then we clearly need what I have called thinking in forms, in inner pictures. And this thinking in inner pictures will, in terms of the outer world, make the plant kingdom comprehensible for us. And in terms of our inner life, it will make the unity of all life between birth and death comprehensible. In my books and lectures, I have often shown that from the moment we first really develop that imaginative thinking, our entire life, from the first use of the pronoun I, to refer to ourselves, which is also the moment when memory begins, all the way to the current moment, our entire life presents itself as occurring in one single tableau. Just as we usually consider our outer physical body as belonging to us any time we happen to look at it, so we also look at the course of our entire life on earth, up until the present moment, all at once, as in a panoramic picture. This is the first achievement of genuine anthroposophical science, to view the inner life as a tableau reaching back all the way to birth, so that we have a real overview of ourselves as an organism in time. What I have called in many of my books the human etheric body or the body of formative forces, what is it but that which we achieve through imaginative thinking? We become capable of experiencing an overview of our life between birth and the present moment as a unity in the present moment. And at the same time, we can see it with the impulses that carry us beyond the present moment into our further earthly life. And once we have reached this point, the second stage of suprasensory knowledge and perception begins, a stage for which it is difficult to even find a name these days. Inwardly, as a method, I have called it inspired cognition. Please, don't mind the name. It is not meant to designate something old or traditional, but only what I have indicated in my books, and what I want to give an indication of here in principle. I said that we achieve imaginative thinking by placing certain easily comprehensible, straightforward mental pictures at the center of our awareness, and that in the process, our awareness becomes stronger. Just as we thus emulate recollection by placing such pictures at the center of our awareness, so we must also develop forgetting as an act of will. Just as we can concentrate all the forces of our soul on certain mental pictures that we place into our awareness in the way I have described, so we must also become capable of driving these mental pictures out of our awareness through an inner voluntary act of will whenever we choose to do so. That is, we must emulate forgetting, just as we artificially, if I may put it that way, emulate recollection. When you do these exercises, you will indeed see that such mental pictures placed at the center of your awareness initially attract all sorts of other mental pictures or thoughts. Indeed, they swarm in like bees from all sides. We must learn to exclude these other mental pictures. Indeed, we must learn to exclude all mental pictures. In a sense, once we have developed such mental pictures, we must learn to empty our awareness again, but without falling asleep. Simply try it, and you'll see what this means. This is something you have to practice, because if your consciousness is only as strong as is typical in most people, then your efforts to empty your consciousness will inevitably cause you to fall asleep. This is especially true if you make the attempt after just having exerted yourself in concentrating on a specific mental picture. That is precisely what must be brought about: an empty consciousness following upon imaginative conceptions. that is, without any subjective content. And the moment you achieve this, that is when the spiritual world flows into the soul life that has been prepared for it in this way, and in that moment you become capable of seeing a world that does not exist for your outer sensory perception. This is the world you see as belonging not only to your earthly life, unlike in imaginative cognition, where you can see all the way back to your birth, but now you see the world in which you existed before you descended to life on earth. That is, we come to know ourselves as spiritual soul beings in a purely spiritual world. We come to know that element within us which has created this organism that lives here in this earthly world. Through cognition, we thus come to know what is immortal in the human being. And I just want to point out briefly that from there it is then another step to the next level, that of intuitive cognition, where we arrive at the insight that our earthly lives repeat. From what I could only outline for you today, you can already gather that what matters here is to prepare your consciousness through a rigorous, systematic inner schooling, not in order to create out of our inner life some arbitrary world, but on the contrary, after the imagination has been active, to liberate our consciousness so that it can behold the spiritual world. We encounter the outer world through our outer senses, in which our will lives, and the latter enters into a relationship with objectivity. Likewise, after we have completely freed our inner soul life from everything related to the physical body, we prepare the soul to view the spiritual world, just as by means of the senses it views the physical world. Then we have the possibility of seeing which being has built us up, insofar as we are built out of individuality and not out of the cosmos, and how that pre-existent being lived in the spiritual world before we took on the physical body that stems from generations of ancestry. And at the same time we come to know what crosses the threshold of death and presses out into the spiritual world when we cast off the physical body. We come to know what builds up this physical body, undergoes a certain transformation in this physical body through birth, is ignited anew through life's experiences, and then once again enters the spiritual soul world through death. What we are striving for by developing certain soul forces is not some fantasy, not some philosophizing or speculating about the immortality of the human being. Instead, what we are striving for is a true vision of what is immortal in us. Once we deepen our spiritual life in this way, we attain spiritual objectivity. And no one can argue that our standing there in spiritual objectivity is in any way comparable to hallucinations or any other subjective creations of fantasy that merely arise from within. Now, by way of comparison, I want to show how we can arrive in this way not only at knowledge of human nature, at an anthropology, but also at cosmology. Time is short, so I can only outline this briefly. What happens in our ordinary life between birth and death? Ladies and gentlemen, in this life we have outer experiences through our senses, and our sensory experiences trigger mental images. And after we have developed these images, we can recall them through the powers of memory. When we look at our soul life, we see that in a way we carry within us the pictures of what we have experienced in the outside world. When I look into the depths of my inner life for a particular mental image, that image then brings before my soul, in the present moment, something that I actually experienced some time ago, let's say 15 years ago. Something objective that happened and that I experienced entirely subjectively. If my entire soul life is healthy, and if the memory picture I have called to mind is connected to the rest of my soul life in a healthy way, particularly if I am able to orient myself properly in the outer world at any time through my senses, Then on the basis of the mental picture I have before me in the present moment, and by calling on everything connected to it, I am able to reconstruct the outer objective experience of 15 years ago as it was then. We carry in our soul the world of our experiences in our life between birth and death, but we also carry something else within us. When we inwardly survey our life in the usual way, then we have before us only what I have just described. But we have something else within us. And through the suprasensory cognition I described to you, we can look deeper into ourselves, not through nebulous mysticism, but through exact methods akin to those of mathematics. There we see that we have within us organs, the organs of our inner being. They are built up out of our pre-existent being. They are constructed from out of the spiritual world. When we apply such exact anthroposophy as I've described it, not only to survey our soul life, which we have accumulated between birth and the present moment, but also to recognize the essence of the forces that rule in our inner organs, then, based on this spiritual understanding of our organs, we come to know the world in its development. This process is much like that of coming to know the world of our experiences through the subjective memory pictures in our soul. When anthroposophy speaks of the development of the world, this is not some remnant of superstition, of ancient astrology, or the like. Rather, it is based on a knowledge of the human being that grasps the inner human being in the same way we grasp mere soul life as a reflection of the events that we've experienced since birth and that stand in connection with us. Thus we experience our connection with the world as a whole. Our memories are images of our experiences since birth, and our entire inner being, once we come to understand it, is a reflection of the entire development of the world. This is what it means to, quote, read in the Akashic Chronicle, close quote, not all the confused notions that are held against anthroposophy. This is what it means to gain knowledge of the world based on true knowledge of the human being. But we must not make it too easy for ourselves, which is what so many people do today, who think that with some concepts and terms that they casually throw around, they can grasp what can only be understood through a rigorous struggle for knowledge. Today, nobody would presume to claim to understand or, worse, criticize the system of mathematics with a few concepts or terms thrown around haphazardly. But people don't hesitate to characterize with a few offhanded remarks what has been developed in a much more complicated way and through a genuine struggle for knowledge. These days, those of us who seek to follow all inner precautions in order not to fall into something subjective, but to immerse ourselves fully in objectivity, are nevertheless slandered or libeled. We have prepared our consciousness to immerse itself in spiritual objectivity. And yet people claim that in the relevant moments, we are only pulling up suppressed nerve forces, and in the process, develop all sorts of hallucinatory images. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to stoop to counter-criticism here, but I still want to characterize briefly how people think and argue these days, and at the end, I want to give you a small example of this. Not long ago, a little book was published that claimed to show how what anthroposophists discover can be readily admitted simply because other sciences in our time have found that the strangest soul experiences can rise up out of our subconscious. As the author of that book explains, one can readily concede to anthroposophists that they experience all sorts of things of that nature, just as these things are also experienced by psychics and people who are under hypnosis or who are talked into believing suggestions or indeed create suggestions themselves. Namely, that book reduces what is most essential about anthroposophy to auto-suggestion. And now, the author does something odd. He shows how it is possible to draw the most marvelous effects out of the soul, and how even strangely far-reaching healing processes, for example, for tuberculosis, metritis, fibroma, and so on, can be developed out of the life of the soul. Indeed, the author describes that even deformations caused by spinal tuberculosis can be set right again through the life of the soul. And thus, why should one not concede that anthroposophists indeed pull up much out of their soul life, especially if they have first engaged in autosuggestion? And then the author shows that there is actually such a subjective life, and that anthroposophists give themselves over to such a subjective life, namely that of autosuggestion. Among other things, the author claims the following, quote, by means of this, that is, by means of the soul spiritual development I have described, continue, quote, acting with self-awareness, self-contemplation, while in trance becomes possible, close quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I did not say anything about trance. I only told you that the awareness reaches clearer, brighter levels, not that it will be led back into darkness and gloom, as in a trance. He continues, quote, and self-awareness in turn is the prerequisite for suprasensory perception. In other words, the so-called transcendental experiences are products of a methodically produced self-awareness in the trance state with a simultaneous effect of a systematic suggestion. The actual agent here is the auto-suggestion. The proof of this is, among others, the explicit assurance by Rudolf Steiner that to attain higher knowledge, one must drive the will powerfully into the imagination. Close quote. As you see, the author claims that in a lecture in Bern on July 8th, I said that in order to attain higher knowledge, one must drive the will by force into the imagination. First of all, this shows you the strangely precise approach applied in scientific treatises these days. For example, on the same page, the author talks about how such suggestions can really be carried out, how someone can be talked into believing something, so that an idea is instilled in a person who then, as a result, becomes fully absorbed in that idea and can even make all sorts of things out of himself as a consequence of this absorption in the idea. And then the author continues, quote, these successes are in the main due to Ku having, for one thing, understood suggestion as an autonomous ideodynamic force that is independent of the will, close quote. It is very important that ideodynamic is in parentheses. Quote, and that he has recognized the significance of this subconscious force, close quote. Readers aside, there's a name here, I believe. It's Ku, C-O-U-E, with a grav over the top of it. End of readers aside. So, what we have here is an ideodynamic force that is independent of the will. Nevertheless, this ideodynamic force that is independent of the will is allegedly what I invoked when I said that we have to drive our will into our imagination. Now, let's take that sentence as the author claims I uttered it in Bern. Quote, one must drive the will powerfully into the imagination, close quote. I have told you today that we must develop our will, which we first come to know through our sensory perception, into the life of the imagination. In this way, we combat any merely suggestive influences. That is, we work precisely in the opposite direction from that of suggestion. This application of the will thwarts all possibilities of suggestive influences. What I have described runs its course in the opposite direction. This is already clear from the fact that these suggestive influences are here called ideodynamic impulses, that is, not impulses of the will, but rather ideodynamic impulses. And yet the author vaguely senses something that is true, but that he cannot yet properly express. namely, that we indeed have to summon our will if we want to bring subjective ideas into our imagination. But this happens without involving the will of the person to whom it happens, the person who experiences the suggestion. As I've always said everywhere, anyone who wants to become active in anthroposophical research applies his or her will and precisely avoids suggestions. Therefore, I could not have said what this author claims. I read what he says here in this brochure and then asked myself whether in Bern on July 8, 1920, I had in some moment allowed something to paralyze my tongue. Did I really say that to attain higher knowledge, one must drive the will powerfully into the imagination? That, after all, is something everyone can do, for suggestion can also happen without any activity or involvement on the part of the person to whom something is being suggested. Now, I went to the effort to look up the shorthand report of my Bern lecture of July 8, 1920, a report I luckily found today. And now you can see what I really said at that time in Bern. I have always taken great pains to show that the path we are to take runs in the opposite direction from that of suggestion. And back then I said in my lecture, quote, "We must therefore exert more and more force to maintain our focus. And this exertion of force, this effort, is what is important. What matters is that we drive the will with all our might ever deeper into the life of our imagination, into our mental pictures, so that we actually become stronger as we exert this effort of driving the will into the life of the imagination." Close quote. Clearly, this is something different. We can only drive ideas into our mental images, into our imagination. When we talk about driving the will into the life of the imagination, that means precisely not to let our mental pictures be influenced by suggestions. It means to take the free life of the imagination that is ruled by the will into our own hands. As you see, the author quoted my words in quotation marks, and inside those quotation marks, he said the opposite of what I actually said. But that is only one example, ladies and gentlemen, of the way in which these days, particularly, the sciences argue against anthroposophy, how anthroposophy is misunderstood. For this booklet I mentioned is really quite typical, and it shows that tendency throughout. Ladies and gentlemen, I have always rigorously expelled from the realm of anthroposophy all phenomena of mediumship, hallucinations, and visions that arise from within us. I have always explained that I consider all such phenomena pathological, and that they represent a descent below the life of the senses, not an ascent above it. I have explained everywhere, and often in detail, that what anthroposophy aims to be, what it offers us in descriptions of soul spiritual worlds, comes from very different foundations than what this author asserts here. And now we see the strange tendency to claim that the very things I reject and consider pathological are regarded as what is justified in anthroposophy. Thus the facts are turned upside down, reversed. This author and other opponents of anthroposophy are trying to make people believe that what I describe are hallucinations and the like. Now, hallucinations and phenomena like that really exist, says this author, and therefore he wants to concede that to the anthroposophists. But according to this author, anthroposophists should not talk about the higher worlds, because if they do, they will enter an area of philosophy, and such talk is really only an outgrowth of theosophical teaching, a fantasy contingent on theosophical belief and teaching. And here we see something highly typical. The man who here initially distilled what he is willing to accept of anthroposophy, even though it is the exact opposite of what anthroposophy really offers, ends up saying that what he is willing to grant anthroposophy is already known these days and is called telepathy, clairvoyance, materialization of psychic phenomena, and so on. But all these things really belong to the realm of the pathological, or perhaps also to that of therapy. After all, those realms are connected. Here I would have to address in more detail what I have said repeatedly in the courses for doctors. Namely, that out of anthroposophy we can indeed develop a pathology and a therapy that go in a legitimate way beyond what the current merely materialistic view provides. But when people start by turning what anthroposophy offers on its head and then accepting that wrong view, they are actually saying that one can talk people into believing all sorts of things. But it has never before happened that people in trance experience such things as astral or fairy tale lands. But that is exactly the point. That author claims it a fairy tale land because he passes it off as fantasy. He claims one cannot experience such things by means of suggestion. And yet it is being experienced. A strange polemic. First, he pulls out of the many anthroposophical results the ones he believes he can understand, even though he actually does not understand them at all. Then he presents this as hallucinations, and so on. All this is accepted. The remaining part of anthroposophy is turned into fairyland, which that author claims could not be the result of suggestion. And indeed, that is true. It is not the result of suggestion. It must be gained through precise inner methods as inner knowledge. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't blame anyone for so grotesquely misunderstanding what anthroposophy has to offer. I do not even blame that reputable and deservedly renowned collection of scientific, medical, and other treatises published in Munich and Wiesbaden by J.F. Bergmann for taking up such grotesque criticism of anthroposophy. For the entire little book by Albert Ziechler is actually well-intentioned. Ziechler wants to do justice to the matter, but he cannot, because there is still a chasm gaping between what is acknowledged today as official, established science, and what is actually needed to really make progress. For ultimately, there is an inner connection in spiritual life between the life in our civilization as a whole and the life of the sciences in our time. And we must build a bridge to ethics, to social life. The science that remains stuck in the material realm, or at most offers hypotheses about the non-material realm, will not be able to build that bridge. Only a science that truly enters into the spiritual realm will be up to that task, because the spiritual is active in the social realm, and social laws can be found only by those who also find the laws, forms, and transformations of the spiritual in nature. Now, in the short time available to me today, I could only highlight a few aspects. I wanted to show you that anthroposophy makes an effort to work entirely along the lines of true science. Indeed, anthroposophy is concerned with arriving at a method that emulates that of mathematics. It wants to work seriously and conscientiously in its scientific and epistemological approach. But anthroposophy still meets with a lot of prejudices today, even though it is something our civilization urgently needs. For only anthroposophy is able to provide human beings with true and satisfying knowledge and clarification about their own nature. Ladies and gentlemen, as I said, I believe that the opposition against anthroposophy will disappear once objective ground has been gained to establish harmony and mutual understanding between the current sciences and the anthroposophical research methods. That is something we have to wait for. As long as such an understanding has not yet been established, all sorts of partisan, religious, theological, or other opponents will appear, none of them moving on objective ground. But those who are actively involved in this anthroposophy and who are serious about it, serious about all that comes from Dornach, they will know how serious and rigorous our research in this realm of anthroposophy is. And they will, therefore, understand that no matter how great the misunderstandings may be now, ultimately, thanks to the rigor of the modern scientific methods and attitudes, a balance and harmony will be found. And we are right to keep this in mind, as long as we ourselves hold firm to the foundation of testing everything we seek in anthroposophy by applying the same requirements that are applied today in the sciences. And that is what ultimately lets us expect the outer balance and harmony. If we proceed with seriousness and sincerity, we can be convinced that from contemporary science and from what anthroposophy has been able to achieve thus far, this is true at least for those who are familiar with both the sciences and anthroposophy, that balance and harmony can already be found now. And this awareness gives us the confidence that scientific understanding will arise, and then anthroposophy's other opponents will disappear on their own. There were no requests to speak. Rudolf Steiner again. Ladies and gentlemen, in a lecture that is to serve as an introduction to a series of lectures on anthroposophy, it is, of course, only possible to take into account a few principles. In particular, today I could not consider what is especially dear to my heart, namely, to show you the bridge that leads from the knowledge side of anthroposophy to its social, practical, ethical, and religious side. Please allow me to say a very few words on this topic, as we have only until 10 a.m. Look at the world view of the natural sciences today. Note that I am not talking about the natural sciences, but about the world view of the natural sciences. That world view lives perhaps in many lay people, and also in people who believe themselves not to be lay people, but who, nevertheless, as members of various monist or other associations, still concoct a religious confession out of the scientific ideas of 30 years ago. You see that this worldview has developed more or less into a materialistic construct. And you will realize that from what many people now consider the only possible way of scientific research, there is no bridge leading to the reality of ethical and social ideals. As we now look at everything the natural sciences offer us, we are faced with the necessity of forming mental pictures, for example, about the Earth's beginning and ending, to develop a worldview. I can only briefly mention these things. For example, we have the theory developed by Kant and Laplace, according to which the Earth originated in the nebula, which is described in terms of the laws of aerodynamics and aeromechanics. The theory describes how the solar system and the planets formed out of the primordial mist, and how the Earth broke off. The theory also deals with the critical question of how living beings could have originated, a question with which we will soon come to the limits of knowledge. And the theory addresses how organic life originated from what was initially present only in the primordial mist, how human beings then emerged from this, and how they experience themselves now in their self-conscious I, capital. Life is the greatest teacher if we look at it in the right way. And in my life, I have met people who took that world view of the natural sciences seriously. In particular, I remember one person who is typical and representative for countless others. Other people are often not aware of this, but they are building for themselves an altar of belief, an altar of knowledge. But those who take the ideas of the natural sciences seriously cannot do this. Instead, they arrive at such hypothetical concepts about the Earth's beginning and ending. They arrive at such ideas on the basis of, for example, thermodynamics or the theory of entropy, which leads to the idea that everything will ultimately die in the heat death of the universe. It is not often that one encounters people who have the inner courage to admit from the depths of their fully human nature what situation human beings are now in regarding their inner life when they take these things seriously as the only correct and valid ideas. For example, based on his feelings, Hermann Grimm says the following, and please excuse the rather drastic statement I quote. about what he realizes is to develop on Earth between the primordial mist, according to Kant and Laplace, and the condition to which the entropy theory is to lead us. Quote, "A carrion bone that a dog would avoid is a more appetizing image than that picture of the world that is presented to people now, even already in the schools." Close quote. And, according to Hermann Grimm, future ages will have a hard time explaining how and why a pathological age could at one time have developed such ideas about the Earth's beginning and end. He thinks that people will not be able to fathom that such things could have been taken seriously. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the sciences that present themselves to us these days as the natural sciences, and I want to repeat that Anthroposophy does not at all want to find fault with them, are fully acknowledged and respected in their sphere. Anthroposophy stands firmly on the foundation of a scientific outlook. For we must take the scientifically precise methods and the inner discipline that the sciences have developed as an example to follow. But they have to be developed further in the sense I have characterized today. This is how we arrive at a true knowledge of the human being. This knowledge, however, is not as easy to attain as what we know based on physiological and biological perspectives. Ultimately, that knowledge shows us that the human being is organized inwardly, quite differently in the head and in the metabolic limb system. Those are essentially the two poles of the human being. I can only sketch this here now in broad outlines, but I have explained it in great detail in long lecture cycles. I want to show you first how wrong it is to claim, for example, that our thinking originates in processes taking place in our brain. If that were true, it would be as if a cart had moved along on a road made soft by rain and left imprints behind. You could trace where the cart had gone with the help of the imprints made in the soft road surface. But now suppose someone tells you that you have to explain those imprints by saying they were generated by the forces that are down there in the earth. This person demands that you explain them as configurations caused by underground forces. It's no different with the methods people apply nowadays to explain the nerve structure and the convolutions of the brain on the basis of empty organ forces. The nerve structure must be explained as stemming from the workings of the soul spiritual element, just as the ruts in a softened road surface stem from the cart that drove on the road. This is only an image, of course. Still, with its completely precise scientific methods, Anthroposophy leads us to the realization that thinking and imagining are soul spiritual processes for which the brain is only a substrate. The brain is only a substrate for these processes because they are not based on the growth of the brain, on organic processes in the brain, but rather on the brain's slow dying processes. The nervous system actually does not have a life of its own, but rather the opposite of life, a decline or withdrawal of life. First of all, room must be made for the thoughts. Parts of the nervous system must die, and there must be a continuous dying, a clearing away of material processes, so that the spiritual soul processes can gain ground. All this must be balanced again and again by the metabolic limb system, usually during sleep or other processes. The processes that arise in the metabolic limb system, with which physiology concerns itself today, dull our consciousness. They quash our imagining and indeed extinguish it. Especially when these processes are toned down to a kind of partial dying, that is when imagining and thinking develop. Thus we carry within us a continuous living and dying, birth and death. The moment when we die is thus only the integral of the differentials that make up life, the differentials of continuous dying that make up the life of the human being. If we continue this train of thought, we come to realize something that the established sciences these days really must practically deny, even though it is the logical result of the continuation of those same sciences. What I mean is the realization that human beings have real, continuously ongoing breakdown processes, death processes within them. Our ethical ideals develop in the midst of these death processes. Thus, the ethical ideals do not depend on continuing organic processes, but rather on repressed and regressing organic processes. The consequence of this is the following. When at some distant future time our Earth will have arrived at a mineral, biological condition of some kind, let's say we accept the hypothesis of its heat death as valid, which of course it isn't, at least not entirely and only in a certain sense. Now, let's say then that at some future time the Earth will have arrived at its heat death, and thus no other processes will be possible anymore. For after all, according to the second law of thermodynamics, there is always heat loss, a remainder, when heat is transferred or converted. When this condition occurs, then the ethical ideals that have lived in human beings will have developed their greatest power, and that will carry Earth existence onward to a new planetary formation. We discover in our moral ideals the seeds for future worlds that are founded upon our current morality. This is how our ideals acquire their real value. Modern philosophy is compelled to speak of mere values, but what possibility can it offer us when it speaks of values that arise within us as mere ideas that are not seeds for future realities? How is that perspective any different from believing that we originated in the primordial mist, as Kant and Laplace described, and that somehow moral ideals then emerge in our consciousness, but only live within us like a mist or fog? That is the view of the person I alluded to earlier, the person who took the modern natural sciences as a law and conceded that in the world the human being is shortchanged. This is how far the natural sciences took him, where moral ideals arise like foam, dissolve again, and everything moves toward heat death, the grand cemetery. Because though the moral ideals are experienced, they have no way of becoming reality. Anthroposophy traces the declining, regressing processes into which the moral ideals have worked. And it shows us that although these moral ideals have only a non-material existence within us, by developing within us, they become the seeds for the future. Thus, Anthroposophy shows us that we must regard moral ideals as realities that are the first seeds of future worlds that will arise from ideality. Just as we see in a seed the very plant that will develop in the course of the following year, so Anthroposophy allows us to see moral ideals as seeds of future worlds. Behind the primordial mist described by Kant and Laplace, we thus see the idealities of the past as seeds of the present world. Our present world is thus the realization, the fulfillment, of what at one time had been only thought, much like the plants of today are the realization of last year's seeds. And what is currently experienced merely as moral value is actually the real seed of future worlds. As you see, we participate in the cosmos not only with our natural organic processes, but also with what we experience within us as moral and social values. We arrive at a cosmology that reckons not only with natural processes and natural laws as agents, but also one in which our entire moral world takes its place as a real world. Through Anthroposophy, we build the bridge from the natural to the ethical and religious world. That is what is especially close to my heart, and so I wanted at least to give you an indication of it in my concluding remarks, as it was not possible to address this earlier in the lecture. The end of Lecture 6.